of neighbors, and the closeness of its people allows for a civically engaged person to have an outsized opportunity to affect change. More than anything else, though, Delaware was my happy place. It was a short drive from D.C., and at least for the time being, Andy. My family was there. My friends were there. Delaware, for me, has always been home. But as I prepared to graduate, I was faced with a decision that no one should have to make. It's a decision that is all too common for LGBTQ people. The choice between living in a place we love or being safe and secure. Delaware law, which lacked non-discrimination protections based on gender identity, wouldn't allow me and other transgender people to have both. When I returned to Delaware from school on the weekends, it was still legal to deny me service at a restaurant simply because I was transgender. If I moved back after college, I could still be denied a job or fired from one because of my gender identity. Most transgender people in Delaware lived with this threat of discrimination every day and didn't have a choice in the matter, lacking the means to move or understandably unwilling to leave their family and connections. This everyday threat of discrimination was not a reality exclusive to Delaware. A majority of states and even the federal government still lack clear and explicit protections from discrimination for LGBTQ people. While an overwhelming majority of Americans presume that all forms of discrimination against LGBTQ people are permanently and clearly illegal, the reality is surprising and sadly far bleaker. And despite our historic progress, in most places in this country, LGBTQ people are still at risk of being fired from their jobs, denied housing, or kicked out of a restaurant or store simply because of who they are. The promise that we will be judged on our merits at work and ensured equal access to basic necessities no matter our identity is a sacred covenant upheld and defended by our government. It is the foundation for any person to pursue the American dream. And as I had learned as a little kid reading history books, each generation has been defined by whether or not they open the doors of equality, opportunity, and prosperity for people long unseen and forgotten. During the last century, our local, state, and federal governments have often too slowly sought to remove barriers and expand opportunities for communities once excluded. It's the fight that led suffragettes to picket the White House for the right to vote, and later for women in the 1970s to expand educational opportunities through laws such as Title IX. It's the cause that propelled Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and hundreds of thousands of Black Americans and allies to march on Washington, leading a movement that included the passage of the centerpiece of America's non-discrimination laws, the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it's the legacy that allowed a Republican president, George H.W. Bush, to stand on the South Lawn of the White House to sign the Americans with Disabilities Act and call for those shameful walls of exclusion to finally come tumbling down. These protections exist through a series of sometimes complementary and other times overlapping city, state, and federal laws. The most famous of these statutes, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, banned certain forms of discrimination in employment, some public spaces, and federal funding. While most of these laws typically include protections on the basis of characteristics such as race, religion, disability, national origin, and sex, most states and the federal government still do not explicitly include sexual orientation and gender identity in them. Unlike in Delaware, I was protected when I was at college in Washington, D.C. The District of Columbia had passed clear protections from discrimination for transgender people a decade before. Delaware had passed a non-discrimination bill for lesbian, gay, and bisexual people in 2009, making it the last state to pass protections for one part of the LGBTQ community, while leaving other parts, transgender people, out. Since then, the larger movement has listened to trans voices and rightfully come to the conclusion that it is wrong to leave any part behind, particularly the identities and segments of the community most vulnerable to discrimination or violence. I wanted nothing more than to go home to Delaware. The possibility of coming back to live, work, and potentially start a family with someone I loved had seemed like such a long shot. But in the past year, everything, from the response of my family and community, to my time at the White House, to my budding relationship with an incredible partner, demonstrated that one of the biggest barriers to change was my own misguided belief that certain things were impossible, that something was too hard, that people weren't ready. And so I resolved to help change Delaware law, to make it inclusive of the needs of transgender people across the state. I joined the board of directors of Equality Delaware, a volunteer role. Equality Delaware, the state's primary LGBTQ advocacy organization, had started a few years earlier, and since its founding, Delaware had passed sexual orientation non-discrimination protections in 2009, and laws permitting civil unions, a precursor to marriage equality, in 2011. The group was led by two attorneys, Lisa Goodman and Mark Papura. Mark, a tall, bearded, openly gay man, had come out 4 years before and dove headfirst into LGBTQ advocacy. Lisa, who sported short brown hair with a streak of gray, had been involved in advocacy for a bit longer and was a master at legislative strategy. Lisa is one half of a Delaware political power couple. Her wife, Drew, had been executive director of the Delaware chapter of the ACLU and would later go on to serve as Governor Jack Markell's chief of staff during the last year of his term. With Delaware having passed sexual orientation non-discrimination protections and laws permitting civil unions in 2009 and 2011, Equality Delaware now set out to close the circle and pass both marriage equality and gender identity protections in 2013. It was a lofty goal. Other states had attempted to do the same, to pass both a marriage equality bill and a non-discrimination bill in the same year. But none had succeeded. In each instance, elected officials had come back to activists. We're only doing one of these issues this year. Two is too many. The same will happen to you, was the message from other state and national advocates. They're going to push marriage because it's higher profile, and you'll end up with nothing. I won't let that happen, I told the older, more experienced activists who warned me. Honestly, no one thought we would succeed. Save maybe for Mark, Lisa, and me. The gender identity bill alone was an uphill battle, but doing it within a month of the marriage bill would be next to impossible. There was a reason it had never been done before. Good luck with that, was the nearly universal dismissive reaction from political observers in and out of the state. Despite my confident assertions, I was unsure if I could fulfill the promises I made to other transgender people that we'd pass the bill. I was 22 years old and new to LGBTQ advocacy. Any hope would rest on building relationships with legislators and my current one with the governor. And so I began to work with Equality Delaware and other transgender people to lay the foundation. A few months earlier, during the summer of 2012, right after coming out publicly as transgender, I met up with Jack Markell. He was in Washington for a college tour with his son, Michael, when he texted me out of the blue. Hey, Sarah. Any chance you're free tomorrow to show Michael and me around American University's campus? While he had called me every 2 weeks after I first told him my news, this would be the first time we interacted in person since I transitioned. It was always nerve-wracking meeting someone for the first time as me. Inevitably, there'd be some awkwardness, something I just had to force myself to break through. I met Jack and Michael in the middle of the open green quad at the center of AU's campus. Jack greeted me with a huge hug, and we began to make our way around campus. But as I tried to show him around, he kept interrupting my tour to ask me questions about gender and trans identities. I could tell Jack was taking me in, and knowing that Michael was unlikely to actually attend AU, I welcomed the opportunity to educate him. You still want to come back to Delaware, right? Jack asked me, aware that I had always wanted to move back. I thought about my answer for a second. I do. But I'm honestly nervous to come home. I can't come back to a state that doesn't protect transgender people from discrimination. I told him about the pervasive discrimination and the culture of violence that many, particularly trans women of color, fear every day due to the not-so-random toxic mix of transphobia, homophobia, misogyny, and racism in this country. Delaware needed to join the growing list of states, 14 at the start of 2013, that protected trans people from discrimination in employment, housing, and public spaces. Jack thought for a moment, then looked me in the eyes and said with a determined tone, "Okay, let's change that." If anyone could help push through legislation that would protect transgender rights, it was Jack. That fall, while I interned at the White House, Jack had won re-election by a landslide of epic proportions, nearly 70% of the vote. A few months after the election, Jack publicly declared his support for marriage equality and made clear he would support an effort to legalize same-sex marriage in Delaware during that legislative session year. While it wasn't news to me, I was thrilled by this public declaration. But the concern that the trans equality bill would be scrapped entirely in the effort to pass a marriage equality bill rushed back to the forefront of my mind. I wanted to pass each of the bills, and Delaware's LGBTQ community deserved both. Same-sex couples deserved and needed the right to marry, and transgender people who didn't even have basic protections from day-to-day discrimination desperately needed action. One of our first steps was to schedule a more formal meeting with Jack and his staff to discuss strategy for both bills. The Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer civil rights organization, was working closely with Equality Delaware to provide support in our historic undertaking, and a representative from the organization would join us for the meeting with the governor. Ahead of the legislature's six-month session, we made our way to Jack's office in Wilmington. It had been 4 years since I was in the governor's office, located on the top floor of a large state office building downtown. After we waited for a few moments in a conference room, Jack and his chief of staff entered from a side door that led to his private office. I had been in that room many, many times while working for the governor, and I knew Jack like a family member. Still, I was nervous in a way that I hadn't anticipated. This was my first time on the outside, advocating in. After exchanging pleasantries, we launched into the plans Equality Delaware and the Human Rights Campaign had for the coming legislative session. The Human Rights Campaign would be sending field staff to Delaware to help organize an issue-based campaign that was unprecedented for the state. Sitting there, though, my palms were sweaty and my heart was racing. I knew Jack walked into the meeting supportive, but this was the time to see whether he was as committed as he seemed in that conversation on AU's campus the previous summer. I was prepared and ready to interject whenever the conversation steered too exclusively into the marriage bill. But from the start, it was clear that this wasn't necessary. Every time we talked about marriage, Jack would pipe up. "And what about the non-discrimination bill? You're planning the same for the trans bill? That'll be the same for the gender identity bill, right?" He was determined and was making clear that both bills were a priority for him. He closed the meeting with an unexpected declaration. "We need to pass the marriage bill, but we really need to pass the non-discrimination bill." It was clear that Jack wasn't like other state leaders when it came to LGBTQ issues. Two bills weren't too many. I was relieved, but mostly proud of Jack. While his commitment was integral to pushing the bill, he wasn't the only statewide elected official we hoped to gain support from. Since we anticipated that opponents of the gender identity bill would import talking points from the fight for trans rights in other states, we knew we needed help from an elected official with strong public safety credentials. In other battles for trans rights, anti-equality activists and politicians had stoked unfounded fears that protecting transgender people from discrimination throughout daily life, including in restrooms, would allow sexual predators to dress up as women to harm or assault women, and particularly young girls. This argument was completely disingenuous. A person intent on committing a crime in a restroom is offered no cover from laws that merely protect transgender people from discrimination or harassment. More than a dozen states and more than 100 cities had passed similar bills without any problems of that kind. These arguments were just recycled talking points from previous gay rights fights. "Protect our children," read the anti-gay signs in the 1970s and 80s. "Preserve parents' rights to protect their children from teachers who are immoral and who promote a perverted lifestyle." Just as these arguments preyed on people's stereotypes and ignorance about gay identities, so too do these new anti-trans arguments. They feed on the lack of understanding of trans identities. They were wrong and false then, and they are wrong and false now. But they were politically potent. Delaware Attorney General Beau Biden, a young, smart, handsome elected official, had made protecting children from sexual assault a centerpiece of his time in office. The son of Delaware's longtime senator and U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, Beau was a rising star in the National Democratic Party. He had skyrocketed to the nation's public consciousness with a heartfelt and compelling introduction of his dad at the 2008 Democratic National Convention, and had served as a JAG officer in Iraq during his father's first term as vice president. Like Jack, Beau was a former boss of mine. When I was 16 years old, I had interned on Beau's first race, his successful 2006 campaign for attorney general. He won in a close contest against a longtime state prosecutor and was sworn in early the next year. Beau and I hit it off on the 2006 campaign, and 4 years later, I returned to work for his reelection campaign during the summer of 2010. In that role, I occasionally revisited the old responsibilities I had with Jack, serving as a traveling aide and driver for Beau. While campaigning together up and down the state, we were often asked if I was Beau's kid because of our similar smiles and comfortable rapport. I'd occasionally hold over Beau's head the fact that voters would think he was old enough to have a kid my age, but he was the type of boss who didn't mind a harmless ribbing. Beau was eminently down-to-earth and notably compassionate. Similar to Jack, he was the type of elected official who was exactly the same behind closed doors as he was out in public. When I was coming out to close friends and family, I had wanted to come out to Beau personally, but given his national profile, I held off on reaching out, worried that I would burden him. Instead, Beau learned about my news through my public coming out note. That evening, I got a call from him. "Sarah," he started. I was struck by his seamless adoption of my new name. "It's Beau. I just saw your coming out note." He was driving with his wife, Hallie, and wanted to call to express his love and continued friendship. "I'm here with Hallie, and we just want you to know that we love you, we stand with you, and you are still as much a part of the Biden family as ever. This doesn't change anything." A few weeks after my meeting at the governor's office, I reached out to Beau to get together, catch up, and talk about the gender identity non-discrimination bill. I told him we need his help to push back on the lies that would inevitably come from our opponents. I worried that bringing up the counter-arguments to our bill might cause Beau to beg off, not wanting to get into the middle of a controversial fight. But he was unequivocal in his support and his willingness to help. "Just let me know what you need," he assured me. 2 weeks later, I ran into Beau again at the vice president's official residence, the Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., at an event celebrating the second inauguration of President Obama and Beau's father. He informed me that one of his top deputies, the head of his child predator unit, Patty Daly Lewis, would be working with us to pass the gender identity bill. It might seem weird that the head of the child predator office would be running point for our trans equality bill, but Patty was perfect. She was a kind, middle-aged woman who worked on defending children from sexual assault, and there was no one better positioned to push back against the myth that trans protections would embolden those wishing to sexually assault young girls in bathrooms. After talking with Beau, I made my way across the tent to say hello to Vice President Biden and potentially grab a picture with him. I hadn't spoken to the vice president since coming out, although I had seen him several times while interning at the White House. I walked up to him with my phone in hand, ready to ask for a picture. But before I could say anything, he put both arms on my shoulders and looked me square in the eyes. "Hey, kiddo, I just want you to know that Beau is so proud of you, Jill is so proud of you, and I'm so proud of you. I want to know one thing. Are you happy?" "I am," I responded, taken aback that he had even heard about my transition. "That makes me so happy. Give me a hug." He pulled me in for an enveloping embrace, a quintessential gesture for the gregarious vice president. It was a powerful moment for me. And as much as I had cherished that signed Joe Biden schedule growing up, this small interaction meant infinitely more to me. If meeting Joe Biden at 11 had assured me of my love of politics, his embrace at 22 helped confirm my belief that despite the cynicism that surrounds politics, there are still good and decent people in the arena. And with the support of both the Bidens and the Markells strongly behind us on the gender identity bill, I felt prepared for the fight to come in Delaware. Unfortunately, support from statewide elected officials, even powerful ones such as Jack and Beau, could get us only so far. To pass the bill, we would need to convince a majority of legislators in both chambers, at least 21 members of the state House and 11 members of the state Senate, to vote in favor of the Gender Identity Non-Discrimination Act of 2013. While the Democrats controlled both houses, Delaware's leading party had always been notoriously cautious. Conservative Democratic elected officials from the southern part of the state, although shrinking in numbers, had blocked social progress for decades. And even in 2013, the number of conservative Democrats and Republicans was still large enough that we would need to hold every progressive Democrat in both chambers and gain at least one Republican in the state Senate. Our bill was not likely to come up for another few months, in May or June of that year, as they always hold the most controversial bills until near the end of session. But beginning in January, every day that the legislature was in session and I was not in class, I would drive down to our state capitol in Dover, sometimes with Lisa and Mark from Equality Delaware, often with my mom, and when he was able to get out of work, my dad would join too. While my parents were still getting used to my transition, they didn't hesitate when I asked them to join me to lobby for the bill. As they had made clear, they supported me and would stand by me no matter what. Delaware's Capitol, Legislative Hall, is a colonial red brick building modeled after Independence Hall in Philadelphia, where the founders declared independence and signed the U.S. Constitution. It sits at the end of a large green in the heart of Dover's government district. By state capitol standards, Legislative Hall is on the smaller side, which only adds to the bustling atmosphere of tourists, lobbyists, activists, and legislators who fill the halls each day the General Assembly meets. While we worked to assemble a larger army of transgender people to advocate for the bill, I effectively camped out at Legislative Hall. One by one, I'd meet with lawmakers. We started with friendly legislators and worked our way out. At first, I felt lost. I had been so used to advocating on behalf of others, candidates or a student body, that I didn't quite know how to explicitly advocate for myself. I wanted to talk about facts and statistics. I thought if I could present the most cogent case, my arguments would win the day. Talking about myself felt self-indulgent. I didn't know how to be personal in my approach, but I'd watch legislators react to my parents. Many of them were moms and dads themselves and sympathized with my parents' fears. My mother would tell legislators through inevitable tears, "We were so scared when Sarah came out. All any parent wants is for their child to be happy, healthy, and fulfilled." Watching her get through to them successfully, I felt like my voice didn't really matter. "I don't know, I just don't feel like I'm connecting," I expressed to my mom in the car ride back from Dover one day. "I feel like I'm useless." But my voice did matter. It just turned out that I wasn't actually using it. What I was saying could have been offered by anyone. Making a cogent case wasn't my job. I needed to make a compelling case. I was ignoring the emotion that was at the center of my own progressivism, empathy. I had understood the importance of building empathy during my time at the White House. But the moment I went from subtly educating to blatantly advocating, I abruptly forgot that lesson. In part, I think I moved to what felt like colder and more distant arguments so that I could protect myself from feeling personally rejected if the bill failed. I knew that for many of these legislators, I was the face that came to their minds when the bill was discussed, and that reality would only escalate in the months ahead. How could I not take it personally, though? For all of us, the political is personal. And the truth is this. Sometimes vulnerability is the best or only path to justice. Those with power or privilege won't extend equality easily. Logic isn't enough. The legislators had to see that transgender people are people. They had to understand our fears, our hopes. They had to see our families. They had to feel the humanity of the issue. And then we hoped they would no longer be able to look us in the eyes and deny us the equal protection of the laws they swore to uphold. There had been a debate about which bill would come first, the marriage bill or the trans bill. I discussed the point extensively with Lisa, Mark, and the rest of the Equality Delaware board. I started to worry that the warnings of the older activists would come to fruition if we pushed the marriage bill first. "Legislators will be exhausted after the marriage fight," I said to Lisa and Mark. "They won't have any energy left for the fight that they are less excited about." Lisa is a legislator whisperer if there ever was one. I actually think the legislators will be energized after the marriage fight, she said. They will feel empowered after making history, and they'll be fired up to do it again. It was a risky gamble, but if accurate, it was likely the best bet to pass both. The fact of the matter remained that the trans rights bill likely wouldn't have had the same impact of energizing legislators. While we laid the foundation on the trans rights bill by meeting with legislators and developing relationships, the marriage equality bill moved forward. On April 23rd, it passed the state house by a vote of 23-18, and 3 weeks later, the bill came to the Senate floor. Activists had swarmed Legislative Hall in anticipation of its passing, and Governor Markell had promised to sign the bill immediately upon passage. I sat in the gallery to watch the final vote. Debate stretched on for hours in the Senate. At one point, an older conservative Democrat stood up in opposition to the marriage bill. "And what's next?" the 85-year-old senator cried in his deep southern accent. "We pass this bill today, and we know they'll come back to us with that transgender bill." Eventually, after a long debate, the marriage equality bill passed by a vote of 12-9. And just 2 hours later, Jack stood behind a small desk on the landing of the grand staircase in the middle of Legislative Hall, surrounded by hundreds of celebrating advocates. "Tonight, with the signing of this law," he proclaimed, "we say to any Delawarean, regardless of sexual orientation, if you have committed yourself to somebody, and you've made that pledge to spend your life together in partnership, your love is equally valid and deserving, and your family is now equal under the law." He sat down at the desk with the seal of the state of Delaware on its front. Several pens sat before him as he signed each letter with a different one, handing the pens to Lisa, Mark, and several lawmakers as souvenirs. He put the last pen down and stood up with the bill in his hand, thrusting it into the air to thunderous applause and countless flashes of cameras. I was exceptionally proud to have worked for Jack that day and moved by the history we were witnessing. But I could feel the butterflies in my stomach as we jubilantly walked out of Legislative Hall. The marriage bill had passed. Now eyes turned to the trans equality bill. Showtime. Chapter 6. Please pass this bill. "Delaware transgenders make bid for equality," read the front page headline above the fold in the Sunday News Journal, Delaware's main paper. The grammatical error aside, transgender is an adjective, not a noun, the headline announced that the time for our bill had arrived. I could almost hear the disbelief and skepticism that had been expressed to me across the state. Good luck with that. We were going to need all the luck we could get. After the successful effort to pass the 2013 marriage bill, Equality Delaware's board of directors and its field team, assembled with the support of the Human Rights Campaign, hunkered down for the next battle, passage of the Gender Identity Non-Discrimination Act of 2013. Over the preceding weeks, we had secured our top goals for prime sponsors, the legislators who would lead the effort in the Senate and the House on our bill. In the House, based on Lisa's recommendation, I met with Representative Brian Short, a small business owner respected by both sides of the chamber, and asked him to serve as our primary sponsor in the lower house of the General Assembly. He initially asked to think about it, but quickly came back with an emphatic yes, possibly a byproduct of a conversation with his progressive and fiercely politically active wife. In the Senate, we had the two highest-ranking women in the chamber serve as our co-leads, Senators Margaret Rose Henry and Patty Blevins. Henry, then Majority Whip, is a progressive figure who could also personally speak to the evils of discrimination as an older black woman who had been in politics for two decades. She would serve as the bill's floor manager, helping to steer the legislation through committee and then lead the debate on our side when it came before the full Senate. Blevins, the chamber's president pro tempore, the top figure in the majority caucus, is a warm but unassuming woman who, through her position, had control over the Senate's calendar. Both are incredibly smart and, as longtime legislators, understood the Senate better than anyone. As we prepared for introduction of the trans equality bill, we worked to build momentum, meeting day in and day out with legislators while our field team knocked on doors and made calls. To begin to foster public support and demonstrate the backing of leading statewide elected officials, Governor Markell wrote a Huffington Post op-ed calling for passage in clear and personal terms. Kindness, decency, and fairness are the values that Delawareans live by on a daily basis. They are the values I have encountered in towns and cities throughout Delaware. We look out for one another in this state of neighbors. Yet for years, we have left one group of our friends, relatives, and colleagues behind. And it is past time to make things right. Just 96 miles north to south, Delaware is larger than only Rhode Island among all the United States. The small town feel fosters a neighborly atmosphere in a state where everyone has, as the saying goes in Delaware, dated, mated, or is related to one another. As a former business executive, Jack went on to straightforwardly outline the economic case for building a diverse and inclusive state. But then he got personal. While this law will benefit our state and our economy, it also goes to the core of who we are as a community. My young friend Sarah, who just graduated from college in Washington, D.C. and happens to be transgender, has told the First Lady and me about her fear of returning to Delaware, the state she loves without basic protections. There are countless more transgender Delawareans who live in fear of or face discrimination on a daily basis. As a lifelong Delawarean, I'm convinced this is not the Delaware I know and love. Beau Biden, whose deputy Patty Daly Lewis was scheduled to join us for the hearings and floor votes, filmed a short online video declaring his public support and dedicating his office to fight for passage of the non-discrimination law. He talked about the need for equal protection under the law and protections from discrimination and violence based on gender identity or expression. And like Jack, he closed by getting personal. Talking about our relationship, he said, "A young friend of mine who is transgender has spoken to me about her fear of living without basic legal protections. For her and for all our transgender citizens, I want you to know this. I support providing protection from discrimination and violence based on gender identity and expression under Delaware law. And I will work with our General Assembly to provide such protections this year." The messages helped to demonstrate that the gender identity bill was a mainstream position, and communicated to inherently skittish legislators that they wouldn't have to stand alone, that these two popular statewide elected officials would stand with them. And reading and watching these two messages, I knew that Jack and Beau were also standing with me. They had already done so much for me through their friendship and mentorship. A year prior, as I prepared to come out, I worried that even our past friendships might hurt them politically. But now here they were, sticking their necks out for me and for so many people just like me across the state. Lisa, Mark, and I had spent months meeting with dozens of legislators, reciting the same stories and statistics over and over again. We'd received strong messages of support from many of these state legislators, and we had our prime sponsors in place and ready to defend the bill on the floor. Our next step was an important one, a whip count. It seems simple enough on its face. You poll the legislators to see who is a yes, who is a no, and who remains undecided. In reality, getting answers in a whip count is closer to herding cats. We had to track down the legislators to confirm how they planned to vote in whatever ways we could find them, which often meant stopping by their offices unannounced or waiting outside their offices to walk them to their next meeting. Some lawmakers are difficult to find, oftentimes intentionally, when they know you're not going to like their answer. Setting dignity aside, I was forced to stake them out, waiting outside a meeting or even outside a bathroom to get their attention when they least expected it. While prime sponsors are the leads on the bill, co-sponsors are like casual champions. They're a little more than just supporters, but they don't have the responsibility of overseeing the legislation through passage. In the Senate, we secured 5 co-sponsors in addition to Senators Blevins and Henry, and 14 in the House, including Representative Short. In both instances, we were 3/4 of the way to the minimum number of votes we needed for passage with just our sponsors and co-sponsors, a very promising place to be. But there are always votes beyond the sponsors and co-sponsors. The whip count did more than give us a clearer picture of our bill's prospects. It also had the impact of forcing legislators to look us in the eye and commit one way or another on the bill. For all the negative stereotypes about politics, the integrity of a person's word is vital to gaining respect. Legislators understand this and genuinely try to stick to their verbal commitments. According to our count, In the House, where a majority is 21, we had 24 or 25 votes, potentially more. In the Senate, where we needed 11 votes to pass the bill, we had a firm 10 votes, with several more unaccounted for. So we were down to needing one more vote to pass the bill. While the Democrats were in the majority, there were a few in the party who were clear no's, vestiges of an era of conservative Democrats that had slowly dwindled over time, leaving us with two choices to push us over the top. One moderate Democrat or one moderate Republican. We needed only one of them to vote our way. After meeting with the moderate Democrat, it was clear we were unlikely to get his backing. He seemed personally distraught over the bill, wanting to support it, but concerned he would be getting too far out ahead of his district. He abhorred discrimination, but worried that both marriage equality and trans rights in one session would be too much for voters to handle. He likely wouldn't vote against the bill, instead opting to formally abstain by not voting. It's the symbolic difference, and it didn't help us get to where we needed to be. Symbolism doesn't change the need for 11 votes to gain a majority. The other potential vote, Republican Kathy Cloutier, had voted in favor of marriage equality, civil unions, and sexual orientation non-discrimination protections, and came from a solidly Democratic district. She managed to return after each election by building a strong relationship with organized labor and voting on the more progressive side of social issues as well. She is probably, to this day, one of the last liberal Republicans in any state legislature in the country. While Lisa, Mark, and I, along with my parents, worked legislative hall, the field operation run by Equality Delaware and HRC had built an army of allies who were already emailing and calling legislators in support of the bill. While calls or emails may seem like a small gesture, lawmakers look closely at the number of constituents chiming in on a particular topic, and it can weigh heavily in their decision-making process. Some legislative aides reported calls 10 to 1 in favor of trans equality, a striking balance in our favor. The field team also collected support for the bill from more than 200 small businesses from across the state, a key constituency for more moderate Democrats and Republicans. Other national groups like the National LGBTQ Task Force and the National Center for Transgender Equality helped us locate trans people throughout the state willing to share their stories and lobby their legislators. These transgender Delawareans were the stories that highlighted the urgent need for the bill, that put a face and a name to the issue at hand. There was the older transgender woman in southern Delaware who was mocked and ostracized at the factory that she worked in. There was a transgender boy who was beaten up after the school forced him to use a girl's restroom. There was the transgender woman who was summarily fired from her job at a grocery store after she informed her boss that she was transgender. And there was Matthew, a 23-year-old trans man who had attended one of our trans community mobilization meetings. Matthew was just starting to transition, and he was slender, with short hair and small wire-rimmed glasses. He looked a few years younger than 23. Out to some close friends, Matthew was still in the closet to his employer, his peers, and even his parents. I was instantly struck by his eloquence and warmth. And as we learned later, he lived in the district represented by Kathy Cloutier, the moderate Republican in the state Senate, who we hoped would support our legislation. One of the more common refrains we heard from legislators, both in support and in opposition, was that they did not have any transgender people in their districts. This was an absurd conclusion to draw. After all, there were 41 House districts and 21 Senate districts. Delaware is small, but even conservative counts estimated that at least 2,000 transgender people lived in our state of roughly 900,000 people. Later studies would estimate the transgender population in Delaware to be closer to 4,500. Matthew, however, was the only transgender person to step forward from Cloutier's district. Despite not being out to nearly anyone in his circle of family and friends, he was determined to help pass the bill for his own sake. Matthew felt that a law like the Gender Identity Non-Discrimination Act would give him the legal tools and personal security necessary to come out and to live authentically. When I asked if he'd be willing to meet with his senator, he quickly said yes, and with just a few days to the vote, we secured a meeting with her. Matthew was fidgeting as we waited on a long couch in the Republican caucus's waiting room. His nerves were no doubt exacerbated by the fact that we were in the lion's den, the area of the building controlled by a party that opposed our basic rights and dignity, that opposed us. Senator Cloutier came out to greet us, and we walked back to her office, a small corner room filled with a desk and two chairs. The sun illuminated the two large windows in her office, but instead of filling the space with light, the bright windows behind her made the rest of the room feel dark. I opened by introducing myself and Matthew as transgender Delawareans. "Hold on," Senator Cloutier stopped abruptly. "You're both transgender?" She was clearly shocked at the declaration. "Yes, ma'am, we are," I informed her, not wanting to have her focus too much on how we looked. There is no question that opponents of our bill tried to paint transgender people into a caricature, but it's always a point I want to be careful in pushing back on. Transgender people shouldn't be treated with dignity because of how some of us look. We should be treated with dignity because we are human beings. The trans community is as diverse as any community. Some of us conform to traditional expressions of gender, while others transgress those boundaries in various ways, just like cisgender people. If our pursuit of equality is built on the ability of some of us to blend in, then we will leave many of the most marginalized behind. I quickly pivoted the conversation to the reason for the meeting, getting to know a constituent of hers. Matthew launched into his own story. "My family, my employers, and my peers are unaware that I'm transgender, because, in all honesty, I'm terrified to tell them," he explained. "I'm terrified to tell my employers and peers because I know that right now there is no protection for me. I'm a student with a 2-year degree and a small resume, and I am afraid to lose what few job opportunities I can find. Because of this, I've been delaying the medical and legal steps I need to feel safe and comfortable with myself, and struggle to hide my identity. It is a difficult and frightening position to live my life in, and often I feel absolutely alone." Matthew began to tear up as he talked to the senator. This bill would tell me and people like me that we are not alone." He paused. "Can we count on your support, Senator?" Matthew was still nervous. I could see his hands shaking as he talked, but he had clearly moved Senator Cloutier. With tears swelling in her eyes, she stood up from her desk chair, walked over to Matthew with open arms, and said, "Yes, Matthew. Yes, you can." I felt a huge sense of relief. I was hopeful we could secure the senator's vote, but I wasn't entirely sure. With one individual and his story, we suddenly had enough votes to pass the Gender Identity Non-Discrimination Act through the Senate. Delaware would be one step closer to being safe for me to come home to, for Andy and me to start a life together there, and for all transgender people to live and thrive. Throughout the lobbying, Andy and I did our best to see each other as much as possible. He'd come up to Delaware on the weekends and try to distract me as I'd count and recount the votes. The weekend before the all-important state Senate vote, when I called him nearly in tears, he left a work conference, jumped into his car, and drove straight to Wilmington to help calm my nerves. We'd watch movies and take walks around the beautiful tree-lined neighborhood I grew up in, each excursion broken up by a frantic rehashing of the vote totals. "Maybe I'm missing something," I'd nervously think. Obviously, there was no new information, and the numbers had not changed, but each time I'd recount, I'd breathe a sigh of relief. Just after 2 p.m. on a humid Thursday in June 2013, the state Senate, the upper house of Delaware's legislature, gaveled in. On most days, the gallery of seats above the Senate floor is empty. On that day, the seats were filled with transgender people and their loved ones anxiously waiting. Delaware is the only state in the union that allows members of the public to sit on the floor when the Senate is in session. Senator Henry had reserved some spots for Mark, Lisa, my parents, and me, just a few feet away from the senators on the Democratic side of the aisle. It had already taken 10 years for the Sexual Orientation Non-Discrimination Bill to pass through the state Senate in Delaware. But this was the first time a bill explicitly related to the transgender community had been brought before the state's legislature. "Please, God, don't let this take another 10 years," I routinely thought to myself. Matt Den, the candidate who 9 years before had let my friends trail him with a video camera during his first race for insurance commissioner, was now lieutenant governor and therefore presided over the Senate. After a few minutes of technical business, he called on State Senator Margaret Rose Henry, the prime sponsor of the gender identity bill. Senator Henry rose from her desk and addressed the presiding officer. "Mr. President, at this time I request that Senate Bill 97 be brought before the Senate for consideration." My heart swelled with pride when she started reading from the remarks that I had helped draft for her. "I'm proud to stand as the prime sponsor of Senate Bill 97, the Gender Identity Non-Discrimination Act of 2013. This bill would add basic protections on the basis of gender identity to their stated, to the state's pre-existing..." She paused after getting tripped up. "I'm sorry, I'm just a little nervous," she explained, clearing her throat. She was obviously feeling the weight and attention of the issue that now rested on her shoulders. The fact that a veteran legislator was so clearly nervous only amplified my butterflies. Senator Henry continued, "This bill simply provides for the same protections already afforded to everyone on the basis of race, religion, ethnicity, and sexual orientation. It would bring Delaware law in line with the values and actions exhibited by Delawareans on a daily basis. It's time for the transgender boy who faces bullying in our schools every day to know that things will get better. Quite simply, it's time to treat everyone fairly," she said in closing. At this time, I'd like to call as a witness Sarah McBride. The Delaware Senate sometimes welcomes individuals to testify when considering bills. They usually try to limit the testimony to a few people. My parents and I would be speaking, in addition to Mark and Patty Daly Lewis, Bo Biden's deputy in charge of the Child Predator Unit, who would be representing his office. I nervously made my way up to the podium. Standing at the lectern, facing the senators, I looked past them, out over their desks and up to the balcony, where members of the transgender community patiently and anxiously watched. I have to admit that I had mixed feelings about my central role in everything, but particularly in the Senate debate. On the one hand, privilege shields me from much of the worst discrimination faced by the transgender community. On the other hand, those same privileges allow me to shoulder the burden of public education with less risk to my safety, security, and economic well-being than would be imposed on others. Additionally, my existing personal relationships with these legislators made it even harder for them to say no to me, and therefore the broader community. I felt a moral responsibility to use that privilege and those relationships to subvert the power of prejudice. "Thank you, Senator," I began. I could feel the lump in my throat. With a Democrat seated to my left and the Republicans to my right, I instinctually gravitated towards addressing the senators on the friendlier side of the aisle. So I had to consciously force myself to also look at the side readying to oppose the bill. "My name is Sarah McBride, and I'm a transgender Delawarean. It's an honor to speak to you today. The last time I spoke in this chamber was when I participated in the Youth in Government program 4 years ago," I said, referencing a Delaware high school program organized by the YMCA that brought students down to the Capitol for a model legislative experience to debate and pass faux legislation. "I had joined the program for my senior year of high school and loved every minute of it. We would take over Legislative Hall for a weekend, and at the end of the program, we'd write handwritten notes to the actual legislators whose desks we occupied. Standing at the lectern, I could see that many of the senators had the handwritten notes from that year's class displayed under the glass on their desks. I was one of those kids who left a note for a senator on their desk, and it spoke to my appreciation and respect for you and the Senate," I improvised, hoping that the anecdote would remind them that I, too, was an idealistic kid who looked up to the body I was now addressing. "I thought that the next time I would be here would be to work for one of you fine people. But life intervenes, and now I'm here for a different reason, to ask to simply be treated fairly." I stood before the Senate and recounted my journey to self-acceptance, the fear of coming out, and my parents' evolution. When I got to a sentence about my dad, I began to tear up. While it was hard for my parents at first, In time, my dad said that he didn't feel like he was losing a son. He felt like he was gaining a daughter. My voice began to crack. My parents were sitting against the wall to my left, and I tried to avoid looking at them, knowing that the sight of my mom and dad beginning to cry would likely make me unravel. While my experience when I'm with my family and friends has been positive, when I'm in Delaware, I live in constant fear that discrimination lurks around every corner. I have to build up so much courage to leave my house to walk down the street, to run an errand, or to go out to dinner with my family. Every day without protections, I am just one person's kindness and acceptance away from being discriminated against. The Gender Identity Non-Discrimination Act of 2013 would allow me to come home to my family without fear. For every young person struggling and simply in dire need of hope, and for every parent just like many of you who simply want their child to come home to their family, please, please pass this bill. I exhaled. A few months before, displaying such vulnerability before that body seemed impossible. But through the last several months, I had found my voice. I had realized that I could speak from a place of power if I spoke from a place of authenticity. Having done my part, it was now my parents' turn. Holding each other's hands, my mom and dad stood beside each other at the lectern, and my mother began to read her remarks. "Good afternoon. We are Sarah's parents, Sally and David McBride. We are here today to tell a story. We have three children. Sean, who is our oldest, has just finished up his medical residency at Harvard. He happens to be gay, but that is just a part of who he is. Our second child, Dan, is a prosecutor in the Delaware Attorney General's office. He's straight, but that is just a part of who he is." And then she got to me. She described my work on political campaigns, my time at American University, and then the Christmas day I came out to them as transgender. When I came out, she recounted how they were frightened my future would be shattered by discrimination. She told the legislators what she had told me. "I don't want to lose my baby." But she explained she had come to the realization that I was not only still her baby, but that I hadn't really changed. The wrapping was just a little different. She's still my best friend, and still a bright and compassionate person who wants desperately to come back to Delaware. As you can see, being transgender is only a part of who she is. My mother, now crying, moved to the side, and my father stepped up, looking sad and almost in pain. "When Sarah first came out to us," he began, "one of the first things I did was I went online to learn about what had just been told to us, and I came to a publication. And it described the treatment of transgender people. It indicated that 41% of trans people attempt to commit suicide because of the prejudice and discrimination that they experience. You can imagine how frightened I was that first day reading that. But I also read that that percentage comes down dramatically when the person is accepted by their family, and even more so when they are accepted by their community. My dad talked about our family being embraced by everyone from our church to our governor. Those experiences, he said, gave us the faith that people are genuinely caring and fair. And it has caused me to realize how much better this world would be if we cared for each other's children like we care for our own." As I watched my parents plead with the state senate for basic dignity, I was not overcome with pride, but instead guilt. I felt bad that they were forced to bear everything before our legislature and the media. I felt embarrassed that they had come to defend me as though I had committed a crime and they had to attest to my character. I worried that they felt humiliated, like they were groveling for respect. As I sat against the wall on the senate floor, I began to cry. A photographer across the room zoomed in on my face and took a picture of me tearing up, an image that would be splashed across the front page of the newspaper the next day. At the same time, Democratic State Senator Karen Peterson looked over at me and got up from her desk. Karen was our state's only openly LGBTQ state legislator. While she and her spouse were well known in Delaware political circles, she had never discussed her sexual orientation or her relationship on the record until a few weeks before, when she came out publicly during the marriage equality debate. If my happiness somehow demeans or diminishes your marriage, you need to work on your marriage, she said, declaring her sexual orientation on the floor of the Senate. I had known Karen since my days working for Jack's 2008 campaign. She had endorsed Markell. Her spouse Vicky and I had taken to each other so much that I started to call her my campaign mom. Other senators saw that I was crying, but Karen was the one who walked over to comfort me. And as my parents continued their testimony, she sat down next to me and held my hand. I think she knew exactly what was going through my mind. She knew the indignity of having to plead for your most basic rights. As another LGBTQ person, she never had to say that. Her presence and her actions were clear enough. When you come out as an advocate to a legislative body, it's difficult to feel empathy or even sympathy from those you are lobbying. After trying to explain your basic humanity to people over and over and over again, it can make your own government feel entirely foreign to you. And when you look around and see no one like you in the legislature, that foreignness is compounded with a profound sense of loneliness. It's enough to dissuade even the most dedicated activist from believing that their government is capable of truly seeing them. That one subtle interaction with Karen was enough to demonstrate that my pain was acknowledged and most of all understood. I stopped crying. And ever since, that simple gesture has served as a constant reminder of the importance of diverse representation in elected office. There's a saying that goes, if you're not at the table, then you're on the menu. That helps to explain the substantive need for diverse representation. But Karen's action reflected its symbolic importance. A government cannot be of the people, by the people, and for the people if wide swaths of the people have no seat at the table. If large parts of the country feel like there is literally no one in their government who can understand what they're going through. Fortunately, more and more out LGBTQ candidates are being elected to offices, from city council to the U.S. Senate. To this day, though, only one openly transgender person has been elected to and then served in a state legislature, and none have been elected to Congress. Yet. As my parents wrapped up their remarks and Mark Papura, a co-president of Equality Delaware, stepped up to the microphone, you could feel the empathy for my parents in the room. You could see it in the faces of the legislators, even the ones who were going to oppose the bill. In my parents, they saw themselves. Unfortunately, empathy is not enough to win everyone over. Now standing at the lectern, Mark outlined the legal history and purpose of the bill, but spent the majority of his time rebutting the dreaded bathroom predator myth. In the days leading up to the debate in the General Assembly, the Delaware Family Policy Council, Delaware's chapter of a national anti-LGBTQ group designated by watchdogs as a hate group, had released a dramatic online ad. The black and white commercial featured a bearded middle-aged man with sunglasses following a young girl into the bathroom at a park. The ad closed with the ominous text, "Is this what you want for Delaware? Tell your Delaware legislators to vote no on Senate Bill 97 today." The ad would be laughable if it wasn't so offensive and sadly effective. The crux of the objection to our bill was that our non-discrimination law would allow predators into women's bathrooms to prey on children. And in the absence of a stronger understanding of trans people and identities, fear-mongering and scare tactics fill the void, embedding themselves as rational ideas in the public's imagination. Anti-equality activists had performed rhetorical acrobatics, saying it was not transgender people they were talking about, but someone pretending to be transgender. The scenario, a completely unfounded one, allowed for a shield from accusations of bigotry. But in the public's mind, the nuance was lost. They just remember transgender and predator. Mark addressed this lie head on. That is just categorically false. There is no interpretation of this bill, legally, that would permit that conduct. That conduct is currently criminal, and it would remain criminal after the passage of this bill. The Republican leader in the state Senate, Gary Simpson, stood up, clearly prepared to be the defender of the myth. "I have been inundated over the last few days